This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The rainforests of Indonesia are up for grabs. Never mind the indigenous people or the wild animals, step right up and clear it all away for palm oil. You just need a shell company or two and bags full of money for local governors. That's the sad story coming out of the island that used to be called Borneo. It's all laid bare in some great investigative reporting from Monga Bay and the Gecko Project. We have the Indonesia editor for Monga Bay on the line, Philip Jacobson. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, it's great to be here, Alex.
All right. You know, Phil, we only have 30 seconds to explain why this matters to listeners in other countries, including North America and Europe. Please tell us how Indonesia at one point became the world's third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions.
Sure. Indonesia has one of the highest rates of deforestation in the world, and this is a major contributor to global climate change. Indonesia also has the most peatlands in the world, and this is a sort of carbon-rich landscape, and these are also rapidly being converted into oil palm plantations and also timber plantations. So all of this is fueling climate change.
When I started monitoring Indonesian news for a big organization in the late 1980s, it was all about logging and deforestation. When did palm oil plantations hit the scene?
Palm oil really exploded in Indonesia in the 2000s. There were some experiments with large-scale oil palm plantations in the previous decades, but it really took off after the fall of the dictator Suharto in 1998. So after he fell from power, there was this massive decentralization of power from the central government to the regions. And as part of this decentralization, Indonesia's district chiefs, the head of its districts all across the country, were given all kinds of new powers, especially over natural resources. This included the power to hand out permits for oil palm plantations and also to mine coal. So what we saw happen in Indonesia was widespread abuse of these powers by district chiefs, who are known as bupatis in Indonesia. And this is at the root of why Indonesia has lost so much of its forest cover in recent years. And it's what we look at in our article, The Palm Oil Fiefdom, and also in other articles in the series.
Yeah, your description of how the Bupatis took economic power into their own families reminds me of the formation of the Russian oligarchs after the Soviet Union fell in the early 1990s. But originally, this was an attempt to put more democracy out of Jakarta and into the other parts of Indonesia, wasn't it?
Exactly, yeah. It was supposed to make government more accountable to people. So Indonesia had just come off of the 32-year New Order dictatorship, which was presided over by Suharto, who is often, you know, he's called the most corrupt leader in modern history in the world. His family stole billions of dollars from Indonesia. And as you said earlier, a lot of that was based on logging the rainforest. So, you know, Suharto would hand out a logging concession to a company owned by a crony of his. And there were all kinds of corrupt schemes that his family participated in. But, you know, this decentralization was intended to It was sold as a way of countering that and actually making these local governments more accountable to people. But what actually happened was the corruption was simply moved down through the system to the local level. And today, Indonesia's district chiefs or bupatis are seen as some of the most corrupt officials in the country. I think it was the interior minister of the previous administration came out with a figure that, like, some more than half of all bupatis in the country were linked to corruption scandals. And it often has to do with natural resources. Indonesia has incredible natural resources, whether it's timber, minerals, or just land, which can be used for oil palm plantations.
Well, let's talk about this palm oil. What is it used for, and how do they make it?
Palm oil is used in many, many products that we find at the grocery store, that we find in, you know, convenience stores. It's in snack foods, it's in frozen pizza, it's in ice cream. It's used as a cooking oil in the developing world, especially Indonesia, India, I think China. It's used as a biofuel in Europe and increasingly in Malaysia and Indonesia as those countries try to prop up palm oil industry by increasing their biofuel mandates, and especially also as Europe lowers its mandate because of all the environmental problems that people are now realizing are associated with these plantations. you know, there's a statistic that it's found in like half of the items on supermarket shelves. I don't know if that's true, but it speaks to the ubiquity of palm oil in our lives. And as far as how it's made, so it starts off on these plantations or farms from the oil palm tree. So they grow the oil palm tree, and then they harvest the fruit of the tree. They send it to a mill. The mill turns the fruit into crude palm oil, and then that crude palm oil is taken to a refinery where it is turned into any number of chemicals that then are used in, you know, consumer goods or biofuels or whatever it is.
Right. I heard some Dutch companies were burning the palm oil as a green biofuel, but now we know it's not really so green. I think they've cut back on that. Now, Monga Bay and the Gecko Project have just published the first of a four-part series called Indonesia for Sale. What is the title and the focus of the first piece?
The first piece is called The Palm Oil Fiefdom. In this story, we hone in on one district called Serian. This is a district in Borneo, which is Asia's second largest island. It's an island shared between Indonesia, Malaysia, and Brunei. And it's where the palm oil industry has really expanded in recent years. The article looks at the Bupati, or the district chief, whose name is Darwan Ali, and the permits he gave to oil palm plantation companies when he was in charge of the district for 10 years from 2003 to 2013. What we found is that Darwan's family and cronies set up shell companies, little no-name companies, to obtain permits from Darwan Ali, and then they immediately flipped these shell companies and the permits to major palm oil firms for a lot of money. So what it looks like is an elaborate and coordinated scheme to abuse, you know, his power as the Bupati and his power over these permits. And then what happened in the places where these companies received land, and not all of them were ended up being developed, but some of them were, they caused all kinds of environmental problems, polluted the environment, grabbed people's land, destroyed what, you know, destroyed the forest, fueling climate change, the story really looks at what happened when he was in charge.
Okay, so what happened to the local people, the indigenous people who lived in those areas that were just sold off to somebody, maybe a billionaire in Indonesia or a Malaysian a rich person or a corporation like, well, Pepsi or Unilever?
Sure, sure. So the companies that we looked at were sold to two multinational firms. There was the Triputra Group, which is owned by a billionaire Indonesian family, and there was Wilmar, which is owned by a Malaysian billionaire family. So the Wilmar concessions were not developed, but three of the Triputra ones were. So the people living around these company concessions, they resisted. They didn't just sit back and watch these companies take their land. In many cases, they might have protested, they might have sent letters to their local governments. And then, you know, that didn't work because the guy who's running the district, you know, what it looks like is the guy who's running the district, Darwan Ali, you know, is in league with these companies. So he didn't lift a finger to really stop them from just taking their land. So people then took direct action. They blocked company roads. Sometimes they burned down. I don't know if this happened in Serian, but it happens often in the country is they attack company offices. And what happens at that point is the company will bring in the security forces. So they'll call the riot police. Sometimes the military is around. And, you know, these security forces typically side with the companies. And, you know, some people try to run for local office. We talked to a guy in Serian who ran for the local parliament. Each district has a parliament. But he said, I couldn't really do anything because Darwan Ali, his party, just controlled the parliament. What ended up happening in that district was, you know, Darwan presided over it for 10 years, and there's 2 5-year terms, and you can't run for a third term in Indonesia. There's term limits. So what he did was he tried to install his son as his successor. And, the people of Serian would just want to know part of this, and they organized against this guy, and there were these two independent candidates who ran on, you know, a campaign squarely aimed at the palm oil industry, and they ended up winning the election. And it was the first time in that province that an independent candidate had actually won a Bupati's election. So it really goes to show how much these people in the district didn't want this guy's family to keep running it.
The article, The Palm Oil Fiefdom, is detailed and it names names. And I'm thinking about activist deaths in Brazil or prisons in the Philippines. I wondered how you can go back to Indonesia. Can you?
Well, I hope so. You know, Darwan Ali is just a district chief, so he's not you know, at a higher level than that. But, you know, we do have other stories in this series, and I guess we'll just see how that goes. I worked with, you know, Indonesian journalists as well on this series. I worked with the people at the Gecko Project on this series. So it was really a team effort. And, yeah, it's something we thought about, but at the end of the day, we decided it was more important to get this story out, and that's how we'll continue to approach the stories in this series.
Well, Indonesia used to be a pretty bleak place. I was there in 1993 in Jakarta, and if Time magazine did an article about Indonesia, it was just totally blacked out, blackened on the page, if you could find a foreign publication at all. So it's really loosened up quite a bit, and I know that there are good Indonesians who are struggling to preserve that fragile democracy. I've been told, I believe by you or by someone, that the president of Indonesia has read your new article. So there may be some hope that this will help get a fairer system in the long run.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping. You know, this kind of corruption over natural resources is something that was overlooked for a long time in Indonesia. The country has an anti-corruption agency. It's called the KPK, and it's the most respected institution in the country. You know, in a place where the citizens perceive their government as being so corrupt, the KPK is seen as clean. So for a long time, the KPK just went after big fish in Jakarta, right? Like ministers, you know, leaders of political parties, that sort of thing, in the national capital, Jakarta. And, you know, it's really under-resourced as part of the reason, but it wasn't really looking at this kind of corruption out in the rural hinterlands of the country until recently. What we're seeing now is that the KPK is reviewing both coal mining permits and oil palm plantation permits on a massive scale. They're reviewing these permits for any illegalities that might be associated with them. Maybe they were issued unprocedurally. Maybe the companies aren't paying their taxes. This stuff is really, really common. So the review of coal mining permits started 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, and they've revoked like hundreds of permits. The palm oil review is now a year old, and, you know, we'll see what happens with that. It could be that they start revoking permits there too. They've also arrested a Bupati in eastern Borneo, and who's, you know, infamously known as the Queen of Coal because of how many coal mining permits she's handed out. So that was a really kind of a landmark arrest because it was the first time they'd arrested a Bupati for handing out permits without actually catching them in the act of taking a bribe. So the KPK can do that. It's just a lot harder to put together a case like that, which we examine in this article, because if you look at Darwan Ali, the Bupati of Serian, he presided over a much more complex scheme than simply, you know, you give me a bag of cash, I'll give you or your company a permit, right, using his relatives and cronies to set up shell companies, which they used as vehicles to make money from palm oil firms. Yeah, I mean, this kind of thing is, you know, Darwan is not an outlier. This kind of thing happens all over the country. The Bupati that was arrested in eastern Borneo, the Queen of Coal, you know, there's been some journalism about family connections with some of the companies that she's licensed. There's been other indications that the thing is happening in many districts. You know, the Serian is just a really egregious example, which is why we chose to focus on it for the first story in our series. But it's something that is really pervasive in the palm oil industry and really at the root of all the problems that it is singled out as causing.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Philip Jacobson, an investigative journalist and the Indonesia editor for MongaBay.com. We're talking about converting the rainforest into money, basically. Would you tell us about the environmental impacts of growing palm oil in these giant agribusiness operations?
The first thing I'll say here is that there's nothing inherently wrong with palm oil, right? It just happens to be a really profitable commodity. And so big companies are, and also smallholders, small farmers, are clearing, but mainly big companies, are clearing, you know, lots of land and planting this oil palm crop on a massive scale. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that happened for hundreds of years with various different crops. It could be sugar cane. It could be beef in, you know, South America now. It's just a profitable commodity, which they want to plant on as much land as they can. As far as the environmental impacts, one of them is pollution. These companies often ignore rules that prohibit them from planting right up next to a waterway. In Serian, that was the case. And there's a lake in the heart of Serian district. It's called Lake Simbulu. And if you swim in that lake, it's itchy. I swam in it, and I came out. I was itching a little bit. So, you know, it's been polluted with all kinds of effluent from these, you know, palm oil is a really high input crop. You need a lot of fertilizer and stuff, and this kind of stuff seeps into the water system. So that's a big problem. And then you see fisheries collapse. So that's something that I've heard that from all kinds of communities that I've visited throughout the country, is pollution of waterways. And it's not really a national issue in Indonesia, but it is something that, you know, I think will become one if these communities continue to speak up. So there's that. There's also the burning of peatlands. So Indonesia is replete with these carbon-rich peat swamps, and oil palm companies, when they ran out of land on mineral soil to plant, they turned to the peatlands. So to plant a peatland, you've got to drain the soil, because it's really waterlogged, and palm oil, oil palm trees don't do well in waterlogged soil. So what you do is you dig a trench through the soil, the water table lowers, and then you can plant it with oil palm. And it's not as good as mineral soil, but it's something. You can still run a plantation on that. But what happens is when you drain the soil of water, it gets really flammable, and it burns really easily. And peat is it's decomposing organic matter. And, you know, if you leave it there for like a million years or whatever, it often turns into coal. So you know how coal fires burn forever. Peat fires are incredibly difficult to put out. The layers of peat can stretch for meters and meters and meters below the surface, so the fires can spread underground. So you've got the drainage of peatlands. And on the other hand, you've also got companies and farmers using fire to clear land for planting, which is the cheapest method. It's a lot cheaper than using a bulldozer. So, you know, you've got plenty of indigenous communities that have been doing this kind of Swidden agriculture for generations, and they can actually often do it sustainably, you know, on a really small scale. But there's also all kinds of transmigrants within the country that might not know how to do it in the traditional way. You've got companies doing it illegally, and so the fires often burn out of control on these desiccated peat swamp landscapes. And so the fires in Indonesia have become such a massive issue, and they burn almost every year. 2015 was one of the worst bouts of these fires that the country has ever seen, and the emissions from these fires are just astounding. You know, for the 4 months that they burned in 2015, you know, they emitted more emissions than the entire EU economy. Indonesia is one of the leading greenhouse gas emitters, and most of its emissions come from deforestation and the burning of peatlands, you know, as opposed to the U.S. or China, where the emissions are coming from the burning of fossil fuels, primarily. So that's a massive problem.
Yeah, there's the smoke. It's a health hazard for the people of Indonesia, but also it drifts all the way over to Malaysia and Southeast Asia. I've seen satellite pictures of that smoke, and it's massive.
Oh, yeah, and it goes farther than that. You know, I think the smoke in 2015 got as far as Guam and, you know, Korea, and even some people say it even got as far as Madagascar. There were traces of it.
Wow. And it's just in the news that a new species of orangutan has been discovered in Indonesia. What have you heard about that, Phil?
Yeah, that's true. I think it's called the Tapanuli orangutan, and there aren't very many left. It's in Sumatra, and yeah, the government is, you know, have to figure out how to protect that orangutan if they don't want it to go extinct. So we actually ran a story on that recently, both on the discovery and also on what the government plans to do about it. So it was heartening to see some environment ministry officials talk about the need to protect this orangutan. There's also been similar statements from the governor of North Sumatra province, where the orangutan was discovered. So hopefully they follow through on these commitments that they're making, and the animal doesn't go extinct.
Are there protected nature areas in Borneo, and are they really protected?
There are protected areas. There's national parks, there's forest reserves, but Indonesia has a very hard time protecting these areas. You know, deforestation is continuing in these areas. Law enforcement is pretty nil. So, you know, if we think about climate change, studies are showing time and again that one of the best ways to protect an area of forest is to recognize the rights of the indigenous communities that live around that forest, that use that forest, whose culture is kind of based on that forest. There's a lot less deforestation in these kinds of areas. So there's a big indigenous peoples movement in Indonesia right now, and one of the goals of this movement is to try to secure the rights to their lands. Similar things are happening in other countries, but the Indonesian movement is particularly strong. So what we saw at the beginning of this year was the president, Joko Widodo, who's known as Jokowi, he recognized the rights of 9 communities to their forest lands, and he rezoned these areas as what's called a customary forest area. So it's a very strong protection for these communities. And, you know, the Indigenous Peoples Alliance in Indonesia, it's an organization, is pushing for, you know, vast areas of the country to be rezoned even as companies are also kind of competing for the same land. So, you know, the global land rush is happening all across the world, and it's, you know, it's happening in Indonesia too, and we're seeing it play out with all kinds of implications for the environment, for animals like the newly discovered Tapanuli orangutan, and for people like the people in Sarayan who stood up to Darwin Ali and prevented him from installing this kind of a dynasty in the district.
So looking at this from the outside, how can we in international society help turn palm oil from a destroyer into something better?
Sure, that's a great question. So it's really interesting to think about how the international community can address these issues in a place like Indonesia. You know, there's all kinds of commitments being made by giant corporations who use palm oil. They're saying they're not going to source palm oil that's connected to deforestation, to land grabbing, to labor abuses, to other human rights abuses, or to peatland conversion. You know, in practice, all of these commitments, they all have targets that are at some point in the future, so they're still using all this kind of palm oil. What they say is they're still trying to trace their supply chains to actually figure out where their palm oil is coming from, because it's a tremendously complex supply chain, right? If you're Unilever, for example, and you're making, you know, consumer goods that we find at Walgreens or whatever it is, you know, you're buying refined chemicals from a refiner who buys palm oil from a miller who buys the palm oil from, who buys fruit from a guy with a truck who buys that fruit from another guy with a truck who gets it from a plantation. So, you know, they're still trying to trace out their supply chains. Nobody's been able to get past the mill level. So, you know, I don't know how effective these commitments really are at this point. I mean, they have, you know, I think it really comes down to the government of Indonesia has to, you know, prevent this stuff from happening. It really has to enforce the law. It has to create strong policies and then enforce those policies. So I think that anything the international community can do to help strengthen democracy in Indonesia is going to further those goals. And it sounds rather vague, but, you know, there's a great example from a place called Aru that I like to cite, where the international community really came to bat for a local Indonesian movement that, and it helped save a large area of land from being converted into sugarcane plantations. And, you know, the people there did not want this to happen at all, but there was this giant company that was, you know, had these concessions from corrupt government officials. So what happened there was, it was in a place called the Aru Islands. And this is an archipelago in eastern Indonesia. And there's all kinds of endemic species, birds of paradise there. It's a really beautiful place. Several languages are spoken by the people there. And what happened was there was this company called the Manara Group, which obtained concessions for sugarcane plantations, and these concessions covered 70% of the entire Aru archipelago. So they were essentially proposing, and more than just proposing, they were, you know, intending to go through with this plan to, you know, convert almost the entire place into sugarcane plantations. And there was immediately there was a local movement that arose in opposition to this, you know, because the people there, they didn't want any part of this. And what happened was it became an international sort of a movement, especially on social media. There was this hashtag Save Aru, and you had all these different groups of people across the world, you know, lending their support to what was going on the ground. And there were all kind of protests on the ground by the people of Aru. A lot of Indonesian celebrities got involved. It started to kind of get a lot of media coverage, and there was a lot of there was some investigating that was being done into these permits that this company held for the sugarcane plantations. And there were all kinds of problems with these permits, and it got really messy for them. And eventually the central government, the forestry ministry, allowed these concessions to expire, and the developments, you know, they didn't go ahead with these developments. So, you know, we're going to profile this in one of our stories in the series. And actually, the same company is still kind of poking around in Aru and also kind of doing a similar thing elsewhere in the country, although it's not getting as much attention. But that's one way that's just an example of how, you know, the international community really played a role in really saving the rainforest in Aru.
Do you have videos or photos about all this for our eyeballs?
We definitely do. So in addition to the print articles that we are producing as part of Manga Bay's collaboration with the Gecko Project, we also have tons of photos and short films. So these are being put out on social media, on Facebook and Instagram, on the pages of both Manga Bay and also the Gecko Project. So it's really high-quality stuff. I encourage people to go check that out. It adds to the print stories, and there's also graphics and illustrations. you know, maps and diagrams showing how these schemes work. We really thought a lot about how to communicate all this to, you know, the general reader, because it does get very, very complicated. But I do think that in the Palm Oil Fiefdom, we did a pretty good job of sort of simplifying everything in a way that people can understand. And the multimedia plays a big part in that.
As we wrap up, for those who don't know, can you briefly tell us what Monga Bay is and then what the Gecko Project is?
Sure thing. So Monga Bay is an environmental news site that's been around for like 15 years. It was started by a guy called Rhett A. Butler, no relation to the actor who was in Gone with the Wind. And he started it as his personal blog. And over the years, he eventually turned it into a nonprofit and started applying for grants and funding from foundations and donors, and turned it into a bona fide organization. So today we have 28 million readers. I think it's per year. You know, I sometimes mix up these statistics. Our outreach guy sent me a bunch of statistics, but you know, we have dozens of correspondents across the world. Four bureaus, there's Indonesia, Latin America, India now, publishing in local languages, as well as the English site, which I'm with, and I work closely with the Indonesian Bureau, which is staffed by four Indonesian editors, and also they have a network of freelance correspondents throughout Indonesia. So we're growing and growing, doing more investigative work like this, and we are collaborating with the Gecko Project, which is an initiative of the UK-based nonprofit EarthSight, and the stories that we're collaborating on, we're calling the series Indonesia for Sale. So it's been really great to collaborate with them. I think we each bring unique capabilities to the table, and it's really exciting to do this kind of work that exposes a kind of corruption that everybody in the development world in Indonesia and the people who are working on these issues like deforestation, you know, everybody kind of knows that this is going on, but it hasn't really been articulated until now. And I think we're really laying it bare with this series. So I encourage people who are interested in how corruption drives climate change to read the series.
Well, I read the first article. It's several pages. I couldn't stop. It's one of the best pieces of investigative journalism I've read in a long time, and it really took me straight into the heart of that part of Indonesia and the issues. We've been talking with Philip Jacobson. He is the Indonesia editor for the environmental group and Power News site. It's a huge, Monga Bay. They've just published the first in a blockbuster series in one of the world's biggest land grabs, the palm oil industry of Indonesia. Check it out at mongabay.com or thegeckoproject.org. Phil, thank you so much for alerting us to all this.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. I hope you have left the table full and ready for action. Thank you for listening. I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.